Hello, I'm Bruce Celery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. We are back. We are back with a new season and a renewed passion for inspiring you to get a handle on your money so you can live the life you want. I would argue personal finance has never been more important. So buckle up and let's go. Coming up on the program this week, navigating your finances in this new normal. Now, this is anecdotal evidence, but we are hearing that separation and divorce rates are on the rise. We'll certainly see it play out in the weeks and months to come. But I'm going to be speaking to Dillis DeCruz from Meridian about how to manage the financial aspect of that kind of change. This is a topic that may be relevant to you personally, relevant to someone you love, or just helpful insight for those of you wondering what's involved. Maybe enough vested interest for you to stick it out a while longer. Listen, a lot of couples are anxious. A lot of retirees are anxious too, given concern about the stock market. So one question that we get a lot is around pensions versus the commuted value of a pension. Matt Ardrey is with TriDelta Financial, and he's going to take us through how to make that decision. The OSC, the Investor Office of the Ontario Securities Commission, has published its findings from its 2020 Investor Experience Survey. And did you know that just 25% of respondents, 25% of respondents didn't talk to their advisor during the worst market meltdown in a decade? Pretty surprising to me anyway. We're going to talk about more of these findings with Michael Tracy. Also, if you are someone who sends money abroad, you might not be clued into the kinds of fees that you're paying, both the transaction fees and the hit from currency. Nick Lembo is with a company called TransferWise, and he's going to be here to tell us how its app lets users send money in a more transparent, and he will argue, cheaper way. Plus, we're going to talk to Ryan Weiss from Canada Life about its new RESP program that employers can now offer. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Let's get started. This pandemic has required people all over the world to do their part to stop the spread of the virus by staying home. For some, this has brought families closer together. But for others, this mandatory closeness has driven them apart. Some family law firms are predicting that Canada will see an increase in separation and divorce in the coming months. Joining me now to talk about how the pandemic has impacted divorce rates and how you can best plan for the financial changes that are pretty much inevitable if that's the path you walk is Dillis DeCruz. She is Vice President of Meridian Wealth. Hello there.
Hi, Bruce.
Such a cheery topic. Woo! This is where we begin our show. But here's how I rationalize it. I rationalize it because it's relevant to many of our listeners. It's relevant to their friends and family so that they have some empathy for what this means. And it's also a bit of a cautionary tale. It not to say that you stay in a marriage just because detangling your finances is going to be so much work, but it's not an insignificant element of the whole algorithm here. Is that fair to say?
Absolutely.
Is this a headline or is this a fact? Do you believe that we will see an increased number of divorces because of what has been going on in the last 7 months?
Well, that's a great way to position it. So I did my homework as well because I had read that there was, you know, an increase about 20 to 30% with family lawyers. And one of my family members, a relative of mine, is a family lawyer. And she said it was upward of 30%. And wow. I've most recently seen an interview with another family lawyer who said they saw it up to 50%. And interestingly enough, predominantly from women.
Interesting. Mm-hmm. Now, there is a whole bunch of legal issues related to divorce. We're not going to talk about that. Our focus is going to be on the financial piece. Yeah. And I want to talk about the specifics. But first, by way of context, this is a road you know well. You have navigated a divorce yourself. What is the number one thing you learned personally on the financial element of that experience?
Yes. So I like to share this because I have been in financial services in the industry for over 30 years. And when I was going through my divorce 10 years ago, you would think that I first thing I would have done was turn to a financial planner, but I didn't. And I am here to say, if I was to do things again, one of the very first things I would do is meet with my financial advisor, just to get perspective, just to understand what are the things I need to do, and just get that guidance. And by doing that, it helps you navigate, and it helps you feel better about the things that you have to do with somebody by your side doing it. So number one thing I learned, if I was to rewind and do it over, I would meet with my advisor way sooner and talk to them at the beginning of the process.
There are a number of elements. We're going to kind of race through to cover them all, but I want to start with the investments, because it's not only what might be in an RRSP or a TFSA, there's also the complexity of pensions. If one half of that relationship has a pension, what is the simple way to articulate how the collective nest egg gets distributed in divorce?
Right. So without going in again to the legal aspects of it, you know that you're going to walk out with a 50-50 share. And so if you have a pension, and this is why it's really important to talk to an advisor early, that pension will get valuated and that will be part of your balance sheet. And a lot of, you know, we're talking about women, but men, I mean, you don't know what the value of that is, and that adds significantly to your balance sheet. So early days, that's something you'll want to find out as to what is the value of my pension and what are the options there.
Navigating the housing piece is hard, in particular in major centers in this country, because it's not so simple as, oh, it's fine, I'll just buy you out. Because in a lot of places, the appreciation of homes and the cost to buy a secondary home is onerous, is the understatement of the year. So How does an advisor help clients navigate that piece of it?
Well, I think you have to definitely look at your cash flow. So there's so much that goes along with that. And like you said, it's just not easy to say, okay, well, we'll sell this matrimonial home, I'll take my share, and then I'll go buy a new house. You know, you have to, it's two parties now where you're not pooling money. So sitting with an advisor will help you understand, okay, what will I end up with? And can I afford to buy a house? You know, the whole thing on, you know, what's my credit rating? Do I have a credit rating? Will I be able to get a mortgage? Will I be able to service that debt? All these questions come into play. And that's why, you know, sitting down with somebody who can methodically go through and ask you these questions before you just assume you can, is really important. And on the flip side, by the way, you know, you might be really nervous that you can't, and they might say, no, you're in good shape. Yeah. So I think it's really, these are all the questions that come. You know, you're so used to living in a household sharing expenses. And this is where, you know, the women part of it comes in, is many women will show up at a lawyer and not know what their cash flow is, not know how much you're spending on mortgages. And so that's why I'm here to say, make sure that you're informed whether or not you're going through a divorce. It's just really important for women to stay informed about, you know, their day-to-day finances.
And the dynamic empirically is that women make less than men, not always, but statistically that is the reality. So there's an additional burden that may connect to the gender of the person in the couple. Talk a bit more about that and what I have a daughter. I have a particular affinity and investment for gender issues that I didn't have before I was a parent of a daughter. What additional advice would you provide to women walking this path?
So I actually provide this advice to all women. Whether or not you're walking this path, is definitely stay involved with the finances. And so, you know, the interesting stat, by the way, is you said, you know, many women make less than their husbands, which is true, but that number is climbing where 30% of women are the breadwinners. So that's good news. But that's a different story. But I think what happens is when women get married, and it's not a form of education or knowledge, is they will give up their involvement just because maybe it's not interesting to be part of doing your finances. And you know, if your husband likes to do it, you say, okay, honey, you do it. So it's really important for women to understand, you know, what is the cash flow? What is our debt? You know, what is our mortgage? What are our payments? What is my credit score? Do I have a credit score? You know, I have a story of a friend who's been married for 30 years, only to find out, and now she's not going through a divorce, but she found out when she went to get a credit card, she didn't have a credit score because
she was on a family card.
Yes. So these are the things that are so important, and even more so that if you are considering going through a divorce or separating, this is really important information to have.
How do you think about time? So some couples move to disentangle and move very, very quickly. Others don't and do very, very little, and it's years before things are resolved. And every dynamic is different. Every situation is different. But what counsel would you have on how fast or how slow to move?
Well, you know, that's a really great question too, especially right now with COVID. And I've been listening to a lot of family lawyers, and one specifically, a collaborative family lawyer, they're seeing more and more couples staying in that matrimonial home longer, just because the environment, you know, people are concerned about their jobs. They're not sure now's the time to sell. And so I think that's a personal decision. You know, on the flip side, I've talked to lawyers where, you know, the people are living together and, you know, they can't wait to get out because, you know, it's just too much friction. So that is a personal decision. And it also depends on the type of lawyers you have. If you're in a collaborative situation, you might find just riding through the situation now is not the right time for both of you to leave and split up and sell a house. So it really depends on the couples and how the divorce is going. Is it amicable? Can you talk through this? But there are more and more options, and people are staying in the matrimonial home longer just for financial reasons and uncertainty.
We are out of time, but I'm going to throw one more tip in there, and you can just agree, because I bet you're going to agree. And that is, with lawyers, you want each member of the soon-to-be separated couple to have representation. With financial advisors, I would want each individual to have that perspective. And, you know, that may mean onboarding an additional person here, but that second objective view could be really helpful. Do you agree?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And if you've both had the same advisor, it's not a bad idea at all to get a second opinion.
Dillis, thank you very much.
It's always great.
Dillis DeCruz, Vice President of Meridian Wealth. Some of the things to think about from the financial perspective of going through a divorce.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Canadians send more than $5 billion abroad every year, according to Statistics Canada. Now, the average amount, somewhere around $3,000, and there are fees associated with that. Those fees can be pricey, and they are not always transparent. Our next guest says that there are even policies in Canada that prevent transparent banking. Nick Lembo is the head of growth for the Americas for TransferWise. He joins us now from the East Village in Manhattan. That just makes me smile to say that, because I can picture exactly where you are. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me, Bruce.
For most transactions, for the most part, how do those fees work? So you've got family back, maybe in some other country around the world. You've come to Canada to work, as one example, I'm sure, of people who transfer money. How do those fees work? How have they worked historically?
That's right. So if you have friends or family living in another country, or maybe you're newly arrived and you want to send money somewhere else, the typical fee structure you'll face if you go to send money through your bank or a traditional provider like a Western Union or PayPal is you will type in how much you want to send, and you'll simply get told how much is going to come out the other end. You will probably get a little icon or information that tells you how much you pay in a fee. But what you don't know is that most of the cost of that transaction is actually hidden in an exchange rate markup. So you actually end up with a total cost of a transfer that's much more than you might know or than you really have to pay.
Right. Which I think Canadians who have traveled can understand that conceptually in terms of a credit card experience. Like, you know, you go for a meal in Italy and you're like, why did that cost so much? Because it isn't necessarily the best rate that is used on currency.
That's right. And just like when you change money at the airport, if you're changing in cash, you know that the rate that you see on the airport billboard for Canadian dollars to whatever other currency is not the same as if you looked up Canadian dollars to that same currency on Google. But we think that's not fair, and really that you should be able to transparently and easily tell the difference between providers by showing the transparent cost of not just the fee that you pay, but also how much the exchange rate is actually right. marked up, so that consumers can tell the difference.
And so how do you do it? If I were to look on your page as I'm about to complete a transaction, how do you, first of all, handle the currency piece so that the markup isn't so significant? And then how do you communicate that?
Sure. So we do two things. Anywhere you want to send money around the world with TransferWise, which is more than 80 countries around the world, you land on our homepage or you download the app and you type in how much you want to send. And we'll give you a very clear breakdown of the cost of that transaction in the form of the fee. And then we'll show you the exchange rate, which in our case, we always use the mid-market rate. So that's the rate that you would get if you typed in that same kind of transaction into Google. What is one Canadian dollar worth in one US dollar or whatever the transaction might be? And then we tell you how much comes out the other end for the recipient. So you can really clearly see how much is the fee, as well as how much is the markup on the exchange rate, which in our case is none. And we also have a little button that lets you compare that price to all the other providers that we track so that you can see the difference with other companies you might be considering or choosing from.
And do you track the new entrants as well, like Remitly or Paysend or whatever, or you track principally Western Union or a bank?
We track the new entrants where we can. So sometimes that's harder to get the data than others, but for the most part, we track banks, Western Union, and PayPal. And the reason for that simply is that we know that most people who are coming to digital money transfer for the first time, most people are actually coming from a bank or a Western Union or PayPal. And so it's the most relevant comparison point for the majority of consumers and businesses.
And what's the order of magnitude on the cost difference? Because, you know, if you're transferring, I don't know what the minimum amount would be, if it's $100 and your fee is X and another fee is X plus a dollar, who cares? If you're transferring $10,000, that might be more material. But what's an easy way to think of the difference for you versus the more the legacy providers of that service?
Sure. So if you are, let's use an easy example, right? Sending $1,000 somewhere, we charge on average 0.67% is our average transfer price. And the reason I say average is it varies a little bit by whether you pay us with a credit card or debit card or bank transfer. Whereas a bank or a PayPal or a Western Union will mark up the exchange rate and bring the total cost somewhere between 4% and 7%. The difference depends a lot on where are you sending that money to. So some countries are pretty cheap to send money to because they have really strong financial infrastructure. Other countries that maybe are more, like say, exotic currencies are a bit more expensive to send money to just because it costs us a bit more to get the money there in the first
place. Could you summarize the apples to apples there? I just want to make sure I understand. Your percentage is what?
0.67%.
And their average percentage is?
Somewhere between 4% and 7%. It varies based on the provider.
So it could be 10 times more.
In some cases, yeah, definitely. So wow. We do research. I'm going to type it right now. Let's say I'm sending 1,000 Canadian dollars to euros. I'm on the TransferWise site and I go to hit the compare price button. And it tells me that I can save $75 versus the most expensive provider in the market.
Wow. So it's big, a nice side-by-side demo. It's like you're pouring liquid into diapers in the 80s, something like that. That's amazing. Now, you referenced policies. You argue that there are policies that prevent transparent banking. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think one of the pillars that we stand for is transparency. We believe, like I said, that most providers and consumers deserve to see to understand how much they're really being charged around the world for a transaction. You know, it's easy to compare the price of milk or shopping around or airline tickets. But with money transfer, you know, we've been talking about exchange rate markups already for a few minutes, and it sounds simple, like some simple arithmetic, but it's actually quite difficult in practice. So we did some survey work a couple years ago that found about 80% of Canadians and 75% of businesses can't actually tell how much they're being charged for a transaction when you give them an example of what that money transfer costs. And so it's not that there's a policy that enables that, but it should be that governments around the world prevent consumers from kind of losing that money when they're not even aware that they're kind of losing it in the first place. So we have seen the European Union take action on this front. The United Kingdom is considering similar laws. And it's something we advocate for around the world, that governments should basically make sure that banks and all providers who provide some version of a money transfer service show consumers the mid-market rate or the real exchange rate, so that they can kind of compare apples to apples and understand what they're actually getting charged for a transaction.
Interesting stuff. Nick, thanks for your time today.
Thank you, Bruce.
Nick Lembo is the head of growth for the Americas for a company called TransferWise. It's got an interesting proposition on more transparent banking and lower fee transfers in 80 countries around the world. Stay with us. Coming up next on Moolala, Matt Ardrey on pensions and specifically the complicated math on whether you should keep the one you've got or take the value of the commuted value of your pension. And later, Michael Tracy from the Ontario Securities Commission will be here to take us through the investor experience survey, some interesting nuggets on how investors are faring in this pandemic era that we are in. You can keep up to date on all things Moolala by signing up for our newsletter. It brings together all the fun stuff that I've done over the course of a month. So CBC Radio, Cityline, Yahoo Finance. It's once a month. I will never do anything with your email address. And one final thing. If you've got any questions you want to send my way, ask@moolala.ca is the email address. Stay with us. We'll be right back after the break.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Take it or leave it. If you were someone looking to retire, you might be thinking whether or not you should keep your pension as it stands or consider taking the commuted value. Matt Ardrey is Vice President and Portfolio Manager at TriDelta Financial Partners, Inc., and he joins me now to talk about how to walk through this decision. Matt, this must be a question that you get a lot from people who have pensions. First off, how do you define commuted value? Just frame the decision that people are going to be making here.
Sure. So the commuted value, Bruce, is If you kind of think back to high school math, is the present value of the future payments. So if we had to give you a pot of money today to pay out the future pension tomorrow, how much would that money be? And a lot of factors go into that, depending on your age, the pension amount, if it's indexed. And the big one these days, of course, is the rate of return that's being used to calculate it.
Yeah. Now, one of the things you have your eye on that is time sensitive is some changes coming in December 2020. Tell us what's going to change.
Well, I haven't seen the full and precise details of this, but essentially what they're doing is they're making changes to how the interest rate is being applied to a pension. So right now you kind of have a constant interest rate over the entire life of the pension. Whereas in the future, they're going to be able to kind of manipulate this and say, okay, for the first 5 years, we have a low interest rate environment now of 1%, but in the future, we think this is going to be higher. So essentially they're making changes, I guess, to try to make their projections more realistic. However, when we're in a low interest rate environment, this works against the pensioner who wants to take their commuted value. Hmm.
So if you're going to do it, you might do some thinking in the short term because you may be further ahead to do it now than in a year or two.
That's correct. Yeah. And these changes are just a couple of months down the road, December 1st.
So let's go through the basic cost benefit thinking that a pensioner or a soon to be pensioner needs to think through on both sides. What are the costs and benefits?
Sure. So if you decide to take the pension, most of them are relatively guaranteed. Now, we always know that there are the Nortels and Sears of the world where their defined benefit pensions are not as safe as they once thought. However, if you perhaps maybe had a government pension or an OMERS pension or something like that, you can be pretty certain that they're going to be around to continue to pay out your pension in the future. So you're getting a guaranteed income stream for the rest of your life, however that may be. On the flip side, the big thing that comes into pension calculations is longevity. It comes into estate planning and what's going to be left essentially for your spouse and your heirs. So if you have a pension and you have a spouse, the most common calculation is the spouse will get around 2/3 of your pension if you die. So, you know, depending on when you go, 1/3 of your pension value is kind of lost. Now, unless you buy, you know, a guarantee or, and there's other things you can do actuarially, but assuming nothing else, 10 years down the road into your retirement, something happens, you die, 1/3 of your pension's gone. If that something that happens is something catastrophic like a car accident and it takes you and your spouse out, that entire pension is gone. Whereas if you commuted the value, it would still, some would still exist for your estate.
Sounds like the pessimist's option is to take the commuted value, that you predict that you're not going to live indefinitely and for all time, or that something could happen to both you and your spouse. Is that a reasonable way to characterize it?
I wouldn't necessarily call it, you know, pessimistic, because it's not always a pessimistic situation in which the commuted value is the better option. Taking a look at one of the big things I noticed where there's a real bump in taking the commuted value over the pension is for somebody who's perhaps been packaged off. So let's say we take somebody who's 50 and their pension's going to pay them out at 65. Looking at their comparison, they have 15 years to grow the value of that lump sum before they, you know, quote unquote, take a pension from it. So in those cases, it actually looks a lot better to take the commuted value than the pension. So it's not always pessimistic. That being said, after you've lived enough in your life, you realize that life doesn't always go into a straight line from A to B. So
what bias could a financial advisor have on this question? And we'll talk in a bit about the math, but if this gives the advisor an additional chunk of money to manage, which they earn a fee on, is it hard for an advisor to be 1,000,000,000% objective?
To me, that depends on the advisor. I have personally worked as a fee-only, fee-based advisor for my entire career of it'll be 20 years in the beginning of October, so just in a week or so. And I've never tried to put that into a consideration. When I do an analysis, I take a look at what the pension stream is going to be and what is the break-even rate of return. If the break-even rate of return is coming out at 6%, I'm not going to tell someone to commute the value because that just makes no sense. But if the break-even rate of return is 3%, well, then there's a definite argument there for commuting the value, because you can definitely do better than 3% just on dividends of certain stocks. Mm.
Just before we go here, and obviously there's tons more to discuss in the actual mathematical calculation, but what level of risk tolerance is required? Because it would seem like the just sticking with the pension is a much safer route.
Well, for me, I don't think you have to have an abnormally large risk tolerance, assuming the break-even makes sense. If you're looking at a break-even rate of return of 3%, we can get into some, you know, blue chip stocks that pay solid dividends, which are going to be well in excess of 3%, mixing that with some fixed income, some alternative investments that generate in the 7-9% range a year, all without taking on a lot of volatility risk. So you can take, you know, to me, you could take your sort of, you know, quote unquote balanced portfolio, the 60-40 portfolio, that sort of risk profile. And in a lot of cases, that will be sufficient for what you would need.
Right. This is one of the areas where I think financial advisors have an easier time proving the value of the advice, because you want that depth of thinking on the math and you want a third party to have a second set of eyes on it. Matt, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure, Bruce.
Matt Argery, Vice President and Portfolio Manager at TriDelta Financial Partners, Inc., to talk about the big pension question and whether or not you stick with what you got or take the commuted value. Stay with us. Coming up next on Moolala, Canada Life's Ryan Weiss will be here to talk about a new RESP benefit that employers are now able to offer. And later, we'll take Dillis DeCruz through our Moolala questionnaire. If you have missed out on any episodes of Moolala, you can head on over to our website, moolala.ca, or to any of the podcast platforms and just do a search for the name of the show, and all of them will be available at your fingertips. You could write a review. You could even subscribe, so the next episode will just arrive right on your device. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Some post-secondary students are back on campus in person, but most are learning from home this year. Regardless, tuition is on the rise for post-secondary students in Canada. People have been able to use the Registered Education Savings Program for years to help offset the cost, but a lot of parents just don't set one up for a whole bunch of different reasons, or don't max it out. Canada Life thinks employers might be able to help. The company has introduced a new RESP employment benefit, and Ryan Weiss is here to talk about it. He is Canada Life's Vice President of Product and Experience. Hi there, Ryan.
Hi there, Bruce. Thanks for having me today.
The RESP has been around since 1998. So for parents, for grandparents, for anyone else who believes in the importance of education, give us the refresher on how this works.
Yeah, it's pretty straightforward. I mean, we know that RESP is probably one of the best ways to save for your kids' post-secondary education. It's tax deferred, and the money that you put in is going to be eligible for a grant from the government, and they'll kick in kind of $1 for every $5 you put in, up to a maximum of $500 a year grant. And so it's a really great return right out of the gate. And then on top of that, you know, that money is going to be taxed at the students' rate when they come out, and that means that they're going to have generally lower tax bills when they do that. So it's a great program to help people save and put that kind of on autopilot.
Yeah, I appreciate you doing the commercial for me, because I'm getting tired of it. I've done that commercial 18,000 times. I am a big believer. What struck me about the Canada Life news is it's a new way in for employees to work alongside their employers to up participation rates. Tell us about the Canada Life program.
You know, we were doing quite a lot of research in how we can get more value and get people more excited about saving for wealth, right? And so one of the big things was their kids' education. And when we did our research, Bruce, I'm sure you've kind of noted the same thing. It's a lot of people just, it's daunting to get into the process. When I opened one a couple years ago, it's you know, you get about an inch worth of paperwork stuck in front of you with a bunch of sign here stickers. And it's a lot of work. So most people get that through, you know, maybe going to a retail banking institution, and it's tough for them to kind of make that a priority.
What's the enrollment process for this?
So what we've done is we've digitized it completely, which means, you know, you go onto our website, and if you're a member through your employer plan, it's totally simple. It took me about 3 minutes when I did it. And it asks you a bunch of easy questions, like instead of, you know, the complicated wording, like named beneficiary, it just says, tell us about your student, tell us about your child. And start to finish, you know, you touch no paper, you touch no pen, we have digital signatures, and we compile all the grant applications, all the work behind the scenes, and send that off to the government. And like I said, get you in about 3 minutes, super easy.
is there a way for the employer to match those contributions? Because we know in a lot of companies, that's the way they sweeten retirement benefits.
Right.
Can that happen here on the RESP?
It can, but it's a little different than retirement because there's a taxability issue to it, right? So that would be a taxable benefit to the employee, but it's possible. But in our words, really, this is about getting more people just access to that government grant because, you know, RESPs are underutilized. People aren't getting their maximum amounts and they're not applying when really they should start early enough. So for us, we're just happy if more people get access to that grant money and any employer matches that they put in, that would be gravy.
What type of products is the contribution, are the contributions invested in?
So we've got two primary vehicles and, you know, probably 99% of people, it makes more sense to go into one of them. And that being, we call it our target date education fund. So probably you're, you know, familiar with these kind of target date funds when you're going into retirement, where we kind of adjust your risk profile as you get closer towards that retirement, bringing you into a more conservative investment just to make sure the capital is preserved. It's a very same principle that we're doing, except that when you put in your child's kind of year that they're going to start post-secondary schooling, so they're 18 or 19 years old, that's what we're really gliding down to. And that means that kind of earlier on, you're investing a little bit higher risk, higher return assets, some equities and such. And towards the end, it's a bigger mix of fixed income to kind of put all that on autopilot for people and they don't have to worry about their risk profiles for the assets.
And what's the fee? What's the management expense ratio on those products? You won't be surprised that I asked that question because I've been beating that drum for a decade.
So a couple of things. We did a lot of research and we wanted to make sure that you know, like an employer plan, we want to make sure that you can bring those assets together in a bit more scale. That's really why people have employer plans, to get some better value for their expenses, right? So our target date education fund comes in at 1.5% or 150 basis points. That's the all-in fee. And there's really no hidden fees behind it. There's no early withdrawal fees. There's no penalties for not contributing a certain amount. There's nothing like that kind of on the tail end of things. So it's your all-in 150 basis points, 1.5%, and that gets you all of your expenses for that kind of autopilot fund I talked about.
What happens if the employee quits and goes somewhere else, or is fired and goes somewhere else?
Yeah, so two options for them. I mean, they can certainly take it to another institution. It's easy to get it withdrawn and transferred, or probably even easier, you can just keep it on file with Canada Life. We'd be happy to kind of do that on a more individual basis, and you don't have to change anything. It's the same website, same set of funds, same fees, and you can just keep contributing and kind of growing those funds up until your children need it.
One of the ways employers have been increasing participation rates in other programs, such as, you know, group RSPs, is, and in particular in the US they do this, is auto enrollment. Could you do that here? As soon as you notice someone looks overtired from a teething child, you could assume that they have a newborn in the house, and then you just auto enroll them in this.
Yeah, it's something we can look at. I'm not sure we can be quite so forceful, but we are definitely letting people know when they're at that life cycle, right? At that life stage, you know, there's other information we'll know about people because they're going to add a new child for them to pay their dental claim or to pay their drug claim, right? And that's the perfect time to let them know that it's not too early to get started on saving for your kids' educations, right? And even $50 a month makes a big difference.
How broadly do you expect pickup on this to be? I mean, we're having this conversation. A lot of people don't work at big corporations, or they work at corporations who aren't so forward thinking on benefits. Do you need my listeners to put a call into HR?
Well, it's certainly available to everybody that we'd have on our Canada Life block right now. But it doesn't need to just be for large organizations. So, you know, right up to your small employer who might have some benefits with us, it is available to everyone right now. And that's really, really exciting. We're the only one to have it right now in an employer space. And so certainly would encourage anyone who's interested, talk to their administrator, talk to their HR professional, and we are happy to have that conversation.
RESPs. Ryan, thanks for your time today.
Oh, thank you very much, Bruce. It's great to be on.
Ryan Weiss is Vice President at Canada Life. He was here to talk about I'd call it innovative. I'd give it the label innovative, a new way to help Canadians save for their kids' post-secondary education. Stay with us. Coming up later, we'll talk to Dillis DeCruz about the Moolala questionnaire. But first, Michael Tracy is here to tell us about the investor experience survey from the Ontario Securities Commission. Just what has been going on since the crazy performance of the stock markets post the arrival of this pandemic. I am also the money columnist for CityLine, and you can check out segments on that program at cityline.tv. Then search for me, or better yet, search for Claire Tansey. She does food, and she's much smarter and nicer than I am. If you want to listen to more Moo La La, you can head on over to any of the podcast platforms out there, Stitcher, Spotify, Apple Music, and subscribe to the show. We would love it if you did that. You can also go to moolala.ca to listen to individual segments. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Moo La La, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
These are unprecedented times, and many investors are experiencing a whole bunch of stress in life, at work, in love, and with their portfolios. The Ontario Securities Commission just released its 2020 Investor Experience Survey, and it looks at how the pandemic is impacting investors and some of the decisions that they are making. Michael Tracy is the Senior Advisor for Behavioral Insights at the Investor Office at the OSC, and he joins us now to talk about the results. Hello there.
Hi, how are you?
So a lot of data. What are some of the findings that you believe are most interesting, most relevant from that study?
Well, it's all interesting, but the
big one... Yeah, because you're a behavioral insights guy.
Yeah, exactly.
You'd like talk to questions about your pets would interest you.
Exactly, yeah. But no, for me, really, the big one that jumps out is the increased level of stress that investors were reporting. So we saw almost half of investors said that they're experiencing increased levels of stress when they're thinking about their investments. And this is really problematic in two ways. Obviously, stress is just straight bad for your health, but it also really impacts someone's willingness to take risks. And ultimately, investment is all about taking risks. So, this increased level of stress is really going to potentially have dramatic impacts on people's entire investing experience, because it's something that, you can't really control it the way you can control some of the other aspects of investing.
Oh, the one data point that surprised me, just following on to the stress part, is that 85% of your respondents said they didn't sell anything, which, I don't know if we can understand whether that was the fight, flight, or freeze. People just froze because they were so terrified, or they were able to be measured enough in their outlook towards the future that they didn't panic sell.
Yeah, it is a little hard to say. You definitely hear anecdotally a lot about panic selling. So it was interesting to actually get a look at just how many people sold. And the other important thing to consider, so we did see about 7% of people sold 20% or more of their portfolio. So that's a huge chunk in a very short period of time. We did this study in really early April. And, the pandemic really got going in mid-February. So in a short period of time, selling large portions of your portfolio. The follow-on thing that we don't have direct line of sight into is whether or not they turned around and bought more. So some of these people may have been selling some low-risk assets to buy more risky ones because they saw it as a good opportunity to maybe take a chance in a volatile market. So there's more to unpack as we move through the pandemic to really understand what's driving this selling behavior.
25% did not have a discussion with their advisor during the market decline. Now, you'll notice that I'm taking the percentage of the people who didn't. I know that 75% did, but still, 25% seems pretty high to me.
Yeah, it definitely is, or it feels like a large portion. The key thing really is whether or not people wanted to have that conversation. So some people will just want to bury their head in the sand, right? They get there, they can see what their investments are doing, and they don't want to have to face reality in that way. The other possibility really is that someone received some form of other communication from their advisor and was totally satisfied with what they saw.
Right.
It really depends. I think there's different approaches to investing. And really, if you are someone who just wants to ride out the storm, there's not really a lot to say. So there's that possibility as well.
Now, I know you didn't field precisely this same study in 2019. You don't have a clean versus year ago visibility on how things have changed, but some of the questions and some of the insight can be compared to history. What are some things that you learn when you look at it through that lens?
The big one for me, and it's a question we've asked now a few times, is how satisfied are people with their overall experience as an investor? Now, this is a little bit subjective as to, you know, what does that actually mean to someone when you ask them? But the thing that really strikes me is how consistent this number has been, even from the pre-pandemic to the during pandemic timeframe. So you had people who potentially had been down 20% of their portfolio value, 30% of their portfolio value, and they were still reporting really high satisfaction with their experience as an investor. So that's the big one that jumps out to me as the one that the lack of change was actually the most staggering finding.
Investors can participate in the market in a number of different ways. They can work with advisors, they can work with robo-advisors, they can be completely DIY. Did you notice anything with as you compared those different groups to see how they experience things differently?
So the first one is on their actual experience, the question we just talked about. We actually find a lot of similarity. Like there's very little, if any, difference between their overall experience, which is interesting. The one thing about DIY investors that really jumps at me from this study is that one of the main reasons they do it is that they enjoy it. It's fun for them.
Right.
It's not necessarily that it's cheaper or they don't want to, you know, have to trust a financial advisor or anything like that. There are some that have those issues, but the big one, the number one reason is that they find it to be an enjoyable
activity.
It's
their version of gardening.
Yeah, exactly. There's some hobby element to it. And then looking at some of the other kind of differences, one that really jumps out for me was the information that they use to make their decisions. So as a regulator at the OSC, we mandate that a lot of information be provided to investors in terms of different disclosures, either at point of sale or continuous disclosure documents. And really, we see that people that are working with an advisor use these very little. They're not really their core source of information. But again, the DIYs rely on this information very heavily. So it really goes to show sort of the different channels have very different needs, and those needs can be addressed through the different ways in which we can provide oversight and regulation in the markets.
The OSC does all this research, they collect all this insight, and for me, my hope is that it leads to action on the part of the industry or advisors or investors. As filter through those findings, what do you think are some of the examples of action that we can learn from the survey that you conducted?
Yeah, that is the big question. So ultimately, this survey was put in field with the focus of finding key data to help support any action we might take to improve the investor experience. In the 2019 Ontario budget, they had unveiled a capital markets plan that included that as one of its key elements. And really, you know, improving the investor experience, there's only so many things we can do as a regulator. A lot of that work is done by external stakeholders or the industry or investors themselves. But the one area that we have a lot of say is really on information and what information has to be provided and when. And in this study, we looked at not just the information they're using, but how effectively are they using it? Could it be easier for them to read, to understand, to access? There's all sorts of different dimensions of this one area of focus that we can continue to look at. And if we see things that would, impel us to action, then we can do that.
Interesting stuff. We'll definitely speak again on the next annual version, but I really love that the OSC has demonstrated such a commitment into some of the qualitative and quantitative insight that we can gather from investors in Canada. Michael, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Have a good day.
Michael Tracy is Senior Advisor of Behavioral Insights in the Investor Office of the Ontario Securities Commission, and he was here to talk to us about the 2020 Investor Experience Survey. Time now for the Moolala Questionnaire. So it's a riff on the Proust Questionnaire. I read that for years and years in the back of Vanity Fair magazine. I always loved it. And so for a long time on this show, we have had our version where we bring a guest in and we ask a series of questions and just get the top of mind first answer that they have. Joining us, Dillis DeCruz, Vice President of Meridian Wealth. Hello there.
Hello.
You're sweating a little bit. You're all quiet all of a sudden. Like,
I'm nervous.
What question is he going to ask me? Okay, number one, how would you describe your money personality?
I'm casual but disciplined.
Casual but disciplined. Okay. What are you especially casual about and what are you especially disciplined about?
I'm casual about buying shoes. And
well, a necessity, please. Can't walk around barefoot.
And I'm disciplined about understanding my cash flow. Mm.
Who is your money mentor growing up?
I think I had many, and they keep changing as I go.
Interesting. And do you find that they change because you need something different?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. My needs changed. And as I progress in life and I go through life changes, I actually look to different people and different sources.
If you think back to when you were a kid in those formative years, who would you say was your money mentor then?
I would say my dad.
Yeah. And what was one thing that either intentionally or otherwise he imprinted on you in those early years?
He always encouraged us to get a job. So I had a paper route very young. Yes. And I started having to pay for stuff young.
Right.
So.
I hope he said it in this way. Get a job. Just get a job. What are you going to amount to something or not? What is one financial behavior you're still working on? We all have them. What is one you're still working on?
Using my debit card too frequently.
Too frequently. Okay. Do you wish you didn't consume at all or you used cash?
Well, I don't like cash, but I think I need to be just more conscious about it. Just whipping out the debit card and monitoring it a little bit more carefully.
Okay. What was your worst financial mistake in your entire life? And don't be like, oh, one time I bought an extra double dose of mochaccino and didn't drink it all. Nothing like that.
Oh, no, I have a good one. I mean, I don't think it's the worst one. I just wish I could rewind. Yeah. I was with a big financial institution and I did not get into their pension plan until 8 years later.
Yeah. That's pretty common. Did you join when you were young?
Mid-20s.
Yeah, that's young.
Yeah,
but I say that because what I find is a lot of people, when they're young, they might hear the wah, 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 wah.
Right.
They just focus on student debt and down payment and anything that's going to come off the paycheck.
Yeah.
They don't want to do because of, now, behaviorally, we have this time discounting challenge, but that they just don't want to make that short-term sacrifice when it would be in their vested interest.
Right.
What does financial freedom mean to you?
Being able to pursue my passions.
What are one or two of the passions you feel most passionate about?
Ooh.
I know. I'm so good.
You're making me sweat. Well, I have my little vision board right in front of me.
Look at your vision board.
I'm looking at it and it's travel. It would be travel. Yeah.
Remember when we could travel?
Yes.
Remember that?
No.
Remember? I've seen these videos of the Air Canada lounge and they go through the sanitizing process of the lounge. And I thought, oh my God, that is so not compelling to me. It is a long time before I go into that lounge again. Yeah. But soon we will be back. What is one place on your list that when the world opens, and it will, you will book a flight within a year?
Well, I can't give you three.
Of course you can.
I'm looking at my vision board. Africa. I'd love to do an African safari. Italy. Yes. And Bora Bora.
Oh my gosh. All spectacular. And you don't want to do that at one time. They're not very close together. Just for reference. What is one money topic you could talk about every single day and you'd be like, woo, love it? And what is one where you're like, I wish I never ever had to talk about this again?
Okay. So it's probably the same one. You know, I just am passionate about telling women and asking women to take control of their financial future and get involved. So I could talk about it all day.
Yeah.
But on the flip side, I wish I didn't have to talk about it all day.
Just do it already.
Yeah. And especially when, you know, when we're talking about, you know, women going through divorce, going into lawyer, and these are educated professional women not knowing what they spend on their mortgage, you know, what their mortgage is, what debt they have. I just went, oh. Yeah.
So women out there, do Dillis a favor and just let's get moving on. Thank you so much for your candor. I really appreciate it.
It's always fun, Bruce. Thank you.
Dillis DeCruz, Vice President at Meridian Wealth. And that is our show for today. If you want to stay updated on all things MooLala, subscribe to our newsletter at moolala.ca. And while you're in the mood to subscribe to stuff, go on any of your podcast platforms and subscribe to the podcast. I am on social media, reluctantly, I would say, but Twitter at Bruce Ellery, Facebook, Bruce Ellery MooLala, and on LinkedIn, you know, you're now able to follow me, which is like, I don't even know what that means, but hooray for you if you do. Thank you so much for joining us. We are so glad to be back on the air. This is MooLala, Money Made Simple. Have a great day.